in association with Newsarama. Welcome again to Word Balloon, the comic book conversation show. This is John Suntress. Today, we speak with writer Ivan Brandon. Now, you might remember Ivan from his collaborations with Mike Oeming on The Cross Bronx, the robot anthology 24/7, or his other sci-fi great NYC mech. Today, we're talking about Ivan's new Image series, Vikings, with artist Nick Klein. We'll also discuss his upcoming miniseries for DC Comics, featuring the superhero Nemesis, called Final Crisis Aftermath Escape. And recently, Ivan and a few other comic celebrities were on the reality show from NBC, Celebrity Apprentice, the Donald Trump show, and Ivan will be talking about his experiences there. Today's episode of Word Balloon is brought to you by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where they offer a wide variety of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, archives, absolute editions, omnibus editions, essentials, you name it, all at discounts of 35% or more, with orders of $50 or more receiving free shipping. Now, there's a lot of product here at InStock Trades with Ivan Brandon. You can get Cross Bronx. The standard retail price is $14.98 at InStockTrades.com, just $9.44. You can get Secret Invasion Home Invasion, Ivan's tie-in to the Secret Invasion series. The standard retail price was $14.99, but at InStockTrades.com, again, just $9.44. Or you can pick up one of the NYC mech trades. How about Volume 1, Let's Electrify? Again, the standard retail price, $14.99, at InStockTrades.com, $9.44. Don't forget about their sister site discount comic book service at DCBService.com for all your monthly pre-order needs. If you want more details, check out both websites, Discount Comic Book Service, DCBService.com, InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com. I've read the PDF now with the first issue, and for people who want to learn more than just what they might from the previews catalog, what can you tell us about the first issue of Vikings?
Well, what I've I will give you the cheesy Hollywood sales pitch, which is what I used to pitch the book initially, and what I use when I'm being lazy and want to get it across as quickly as possible. But if you've watched The Sopranos, and I know lots of people have, and you go back and look at I believe it's the very first season where Christopher is sort of a young thug who wants to gain respect and wear the nice suits and be the important Tony Soprano gangster, pulls off, you know, heists and jobs to get himself noticed, to get himself prominence, but inevitably pulls off sort of the wrong heists and gets himself the wrong kind of attention. And basically where we start off is a similar context, and you have these two brothers, Finn and Eagle, who have sort of glamorized and idealized in their head what a Viking raider is, and have visualized this very sort of what would be John Wayne for them of Vikings and this sexy ideal that they want to live up to, and if you know are sort of going about it by killing and stealing. And doing everything they can to gain attention, and basically where Viking starts off is it teaches them that not all attention is good attention, and that you know they learn very quickly the repercussions of doing these things the way that they are doing them, and you know, as you've read at this point, the consequences are horrific and severe. And so yeah, that's pretty much where we start off. We also have a king and his daughter, a Viking king who married a British queen who then passed away, trying to raise their daughter in a British royalty setting. But you know, with his sort of his Viking ways and Viking upbringing, the first issue you know deals with these characters sort of dealing with the reality of what it means to be what they hope.
I find it interesting that a guy like you that has written so much science fiction would do something like this that goes back to the year 1000.
To whatever degree, any of these stories all look toward the future, and I think there is a very not immediately obvious, but there are giant parallels between what we're going through now as a society dealing with, you know, with dealing with technology and with the internet and so on, and the expansion of being able to connect with people across the world in an immediate way. You know, there's huge parallels between that and what the Vikings were experiencing, and you know, if you look at if you look basically at what the you know, any a Viking crew going out to explore and find new lands. I mean, it's essentially, I mean, these guys are astronauts. They're going out. They don't know that there's anything. At the end of their journey, they're going off in a shitty wooden craft, you know, out into the middle of nothing.
To the edge of the Earth, possibly.
Possibly to the edge of the Earth, possibly worse. I mean, these people are you know, they're people worshipping pagan gods and with beliefs in some pretty... some pretty horrific and nefarious things, and you know, one false turn, and you know, for all you know, you fall into the pit of Hades. So, I mean, there are huge parallels between the exploration of the new world and our explanation, our exploration of what is, I guess, a new world of technology, and with, you know, in this case, like I said, space exploration. I mean, there's definitely a lot to be had in common. I mean, eventually, you know, eventually, if we were to ever find, you know, any kind of new civilization, I mean, we've got a very similar goal.
Well,
whether you're in a boat to the Middle East, which, you know, which didn't exist to your way of thinking before you got to it, you know, heading out and finding people on Mars is no different.
I also like how the Viking king speaks as a futurist in conversation with his daughter to explain why they've left the comfort of, you know, England and the kingdom to explore this new world and the reasons why. And there are very modern things that this man says to his daughter about this.
Yeah, well, he's, you know, to his way of thinking, the things his father could picture as possible compared to, you know, to what they're experiencing, it couldn't be, you know, it couldn't be more futuristic. I mean, where they are from his childhood going to the point where we start the book, it just, you know, it could not be more profound of a difference.
And,
I mean, for him,
sees the same future in his grandchildren to come, and hopes,
yeah,
for
absolutely,
that kind of possibility, and even encourages his daughter that we have to keep going. This isn't, you know, this isn't the end. This is the beginning.
Well, yeah, I mean, from his standpoint, he's an old man, and you know, he's reached sort of the furthest reach of what he sees as infinite possibility. And so what his kids and what his grandkids, what they are capable of, there's no way for him to gauge the reach of what's possible here. So for him, you know, the conversation had in the book is about why a rich king would not just retire with everything that he had. And for him, it's not about retiring, and it's not about the money. It's about the future, and it's about attaining and grabbing onto, you know, that bit of experience. You know, and characters are characters. I mean, a guy in the year 1000, or the guy in the year 5000. It's just a guy, you know, dealing with what any of us deal with. Nobody stops and says, you know, now. Nobody envisions, somebody in the 1920s would see us as some weird ass sci-fi movie, but we're not. You know, we're you know what I'm saying? I mean,
absolutely.
You look at it from that perspective. See, the reverse has to also be true. A guy in the 1920s is just a guy, and a guy in the 5000 is just a guy. And you know, I can't go through these things without really connecting with those characters on a personal level and figuring out, you know, putting yourself in those shoes, not in terms of, you know, what you're wearing or what the landscape of the place is, but who you are as a person.
The first story arc, how many issues is this going to be?
First story arc is 5 issues. We are basically trying to do, you know, something that I guess is somewhat unique these days, but didn't used to be. But basically what we're trying to do is something where you have these issues that are very episodic. Each issue has its own sort of specific standalone arc, and then there's a second arc that I guess is the season, and we'll end that on, you know, the equivalent of a season finale type thing, and then go back and and take a break between between our seasons, and then go back and start again. So we're trying to do each arc as a reasonably self-contained thing, and each part of each arc as a self-contained thing. I mean, I think you know, there is we're in sort of a weird time in terms of non-superhero stuff and how people interact with that, just from a purchase level. And I think people, you know, you have people complaining about remorse with purchasing something that is very clearly a part of a trade, and then you have the whole, you know, waiting for trade dynamic. And I think that comes as a result of people who realize that they have spent $3 on a book and haven't felt fulfilled, and then they've gotten a $20 book and have been. So I think what I'm trying to do is trying to create something where the $3 episode is as moving and is as fulfilling as the, you know, as the total picture in the end, and make it rather than a big story cut into pieces, make it, you know, in this case, five stories that composed make up one big one.
How did you find your artist on this?
I went through quite a few different artists. Anybody who's worked on something like this, where it's a creator own book and you're sort of doing it from scratch, sort of by you know, with only your own sort of passion to power it, knows that it's kind of hard to get these things off the ground. So I mean, I went through a few different iterations of dealing with artists who were into it, but couldn't quite make things work in terms of the time necessary to get things through, or you know, any number of different permutations. When I finally got to Nick was, oddly enough, an artist that was recommended to me by Axel Alonso, and we were having lunch somewhere, and we were talking about, you know, new and different artists who had come into to Marvel, and I asked him which of the new breed had sort of had connected with him the most, and Nick Klein was someone that he mentioned, and I went out and looked Nick up, and Nick was doing some really incredible, really unique, progressive stuff, and I sent him an email. We started a dialogue, and Nick actually said no at first, because Nick basically wasn't sure that he could give. He was just starting out in comics, and he wasn't sure that he could give this the kind of attention that it needed.
Okay.
So he really connected with it, but he realized that it was sort of a mammoth task for him, and he didn't want to commit unless he could. He could really commit and make sure that he could do, you know, something that was at the full extent of his talents and his passions and so on and so forth. We actually didn't agree to do it together until we were positive that we could figure out a way to, you know, to where he could spend the time that he needed to make it right. And I'm actually, you know, very glad that that it was that, rather than, you know, oftentimes when some of these books are trying, I've been actually super lucky and I've never had this problem, but oftentimes when you're starting a book like this and you're not dealing with a big two book with a giant budget behind it or what have you, you end up with guys that sort of have to squeeze it in.
Sure.
And aren't able to do sort of something to the full breadth of their powers, so to speak. And I'm glad that we were able to work it out, that Nick is only doing this. This is his main work right now, and he's just absurdly devoted to, you know, to doing the best possible thing that he can create. So it's an interesting thing, because you have a guy who hasn't done a ton of comics work.
Uh-huh.
So he's a very unique voice. He's sort of not he hasn't been beat down by all the things that a lot of us have been beaten down by, and he's full of optimism and passion, and it really, really, the pages from, you know, if you go back and look through the issue that I sent you, you can see the progression from the first page to the last is a profound improvement in his storytelling. It starts out amazing and ends more amazing. It's really impressive to watch him sort of evolve. And I'm actually sort of kind of scared at the rate that he's growing, you know, by issue five, I don't know if it's going to be a book that that is possible on paper. We might have to contain it in a vial or something.
The colors are amazing, and I really, yeah. You know, who is your colorist, and you know,
Nick,
you could probably do a better job.
Nick is a painter, and you know, you'll see all of his stuff that he did for Marvel was all fully painted stuff, and obviously. It's a whole different ballpark to do a completely painted book, and you know, maybe one day we'll endeavor to do that. But basically, everything that he approaches is from the perspective of a painter. So some of it digital, some of it is actually in the pages. There are painted, you know, hand painted elements. But yeah, it's everything. Everything is Nick, and everything is
okay.
Is Nick being a crazy person?
Well, it's beautiful. I mean, I think I see what you're saying about his drawing, and I would, you know, obviously then. Pile on more praise for his colors as well, because yeah, it's just it's a very eye-catching book, and I like in the same way that I like the way is it Val Staples that colors for Criminal? Who colors for Criminal?
Yeah, Val Staples.
Okay, there you go. And the way Val colors Criminal, I mean these colors do evoke the mood of the moment in each panel, and you know it's cool. I mean, and it has some great surrealistic moments, and it has some very good realistic moments as well.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, a lot of the stuff that Nick is doing, you know, is some of it's more subtle than other parts of it, but everything is sort of evocative of, you know, you'll see the palettes that he uses in creating the ambience of a certain time of day and whatever, and it's a very sort of a lot of it is sort of weird subliminal emotional stuff that he's trying to evoke. It's again, it's really interesting to sort of watch him work. For me, knowing what I put into a script and what he's given. And to see what I get back, it's really amazing to see, you know, to see things that are fleshed out past, you know, way past what he's handed, but also, I mean, just making the surreal real, even in some cases, like just very, very everything is grounded. I mean, everything that he does, whether something is painted next to something that's not, you know, everything that he's doing is a grounded and real expression that, you know, that I think people, well, everybody that the few people that I've sent the book to have all connected with. So, I mean, it's really, really amazing to watch him. I could not be happier with him. The book is not a typical format comic book. It's an oversized book. It's, when I say prestige format, people have a very specific thing that they picture, and this is not that. But it's a prestige format for sure. It's beautiful, beautiful. The laminate process is a very specific thing on the cover, and we brought it to, for the first time last weekend, Joe Keating, Image's marketing guy, brought it to a Comics Pro event that they held in Memphis and showed it to the retailers for the first time, and it was literally like, you know, a scene out of Wall Street. Where there was a diamond rep taking orders by hand and him waving the copy around and people just placing hundreds and hundreds of copies of orders on the spot.
That a boy. Very good.
And we had a very, very surprising and very, very interesting weekend. The demand for the book upon actually seeing it was just completely flooring. And it's a unique looking book. I had an idea a while back, and I've talked about this with Image for a while, and this is the first time that I've actually been able to do it. Is, you know, that a new comic should sort of have a unique. You know, music has sort of gone very digital these days, but mm-hmm. There was a while where, you know, whomever big band would come out with a new album, and the CD itself would be, you know, some weird plastic. You know, there was that crazy Pet Shop Boys that was like plastic orange with bumps on it. And these really unique sort of very, very bold
packaging
declarations that you know, I've created something new and it's worth your time. And I'd wanted to do something like that for a long, long time with comics. But, you know, this stuff is cross prohibitive. We're not in a super great time, you know, financially as an economy, and comics is no different in that regard. But we basically went through and tried to figure out a way to a lot of the books, Image and otherwise, have gone and raised their prices to $350, $4 and so on, and we wanted to find out a way to, rather than put that burden on the buyer, to sort of entice them to you know, incentivized it the other way. Basically, put out a $3 book that was bigger and sort of bolder than some of the other books. And so we went and priced out this really crazy elaborate format that we are printing overseas, which required us to excuse me to work like 2 months ahead on each issue.
Okay.
To basically be able to do these things overseas at an affordable cost for us to put out this thing that looks like it's worth, you know, to basically put out something for $3 that looks like it's worth $20. But it's hard to explain it verbally and do it justice. But I mean, the retailers at Comics Pro were just completely blown away. So I mean, and hopefully that means it worked. But when people see it, I think it will be very clear that it's not. It definitely stands out on the shelf. It does not look like any of the other books, and it definitely looks like it's worth your $3. So we've definitely done quite a bit to make it accessible, to make it appealing, and to make it affordable. So
excellent, man. Well, let's one thing in particular that you have coming up that I'm really curious about is the Final Crisis Aftermath miniseries with Nemesis. Is that Escape?
Uh-huh. Yeah, Escape.
Well, first of all, Nemesis, one of my favorite characters of the 80s. Loved him in Brave and Bold. And I love what Gail's been doing with him in Wonder Woman. But, was this something you wanted, or was this something that was offered to you? How did you end up on the book?
Sort of a combination of all of the above. It was, I had been talking to Dan DiDio for, God, probably about 2 years now. And I was approached a while back about, anything at DC that I thought, I'd connect with, and we sort of went back and forth for a while on different things, and there were a couple things that I was supposed to do that didn't quite work out, and finally we settled on this, and it was basically, the pitch that I was given was that it was basically to do a book that is my book, if that makes any sense, like something that really reads like an Ivan Brandon creator-owned book, but within the DC universe. It's been a super collaborative endeavor between Dan and I, and now Dan's assistant on this, Rex Ogle, they basically came to me originally with a really loose, like literally, I think two sentences of a purpose, I guess.
Okay.
In terms of what the book, what purpose the book should serve in the DCU, and I came back to him a couple weeks later with a sort of a crazy take on how we could handle it, and they came back to me with even crazier ideas of different things that we could do, and I think we've been working on this more or less since August. So it's definitely had a lot of time to become this very very strange and different DC comic. So it's going to be a very hard thing to explain, but I'm going to try to explain it anyway. But basically, it is a. If you think of it in terms with the last time I said I compared it to Lost, someone a friend of mine laughed and said that no pressure. Basically, my intent with the first issue of Escape is to give people the experience of something like a Lost, where they go in. It's an overwhelming and strange and confusing environment. Nemesis wakes up in the Electric City. Doesn't know how he got there, doesn't know why he's there. He's surrounded by people that he recognizes, but who won't talk to him. there are the faceless global peace agents who inhabit the world and speak they give him information, but it's not super clear how pertinent it is or how he can apply it to his situation. It's a very, very strange environment, and I hate to say that it's strange because people picture something that's sort of obtuse and what have you, it's hard to explain in that I think it's a very mainstream thing, but it's definitely not a stereotypically mainstream thing. So basically, when I say that it's a strange, it's an unraveling sort of mystery. It's more a Lost than it is a Twin Peaks, much as I love Twin Peaks. You know, it's definitely it definitely has a very mainstream voice and a very modern voice, but we're doing very, very different things than you typically find in a DC comic. And unfortunately, you know, it's hard to explain only in that part of the charm of it is that even Nemesis doesn't really know what is happening to him.
Sure.
So it's hard for me to explain what's happening to him.
It sounds...
because that's kind of part of the story. But basically, yeah, Nemesis wakes up in Electric City, surrounded by faceless global peace agents, and he can't get out, and nobody will tell him why he's there, and nobody is necessarily looking to harm him, at least obviously. But there's no way for him to get out of it, and he basically has to sort of figure out why he's there and what it is that they want from him.
It sounds a bit like The Prisoner in a good way.
The Prisoner. I didn't make The Prisoner reference only because I know not everyone has seen The Prisoner. It's old and it's not a.
But it is cool.
It's an old British show, but but definitely The Prisoner is a huge influence. Dan is a huge fan of The Prisoner, and I'm a huge fan of The Prisoner, and it was definitely, you know, it's definitely a big part of our inspiration in it. If you have seen The Prisoner, we definitely there are definite similarities in the feeling that our intent is for you to feel when you're reading through the first issue of Escape.
Well, and this is great because this is really, other than the brave and bold, Nemesis is always, and even in those cases, Nemesis was always a second tier guy. So it's
going
to be fun kind of having him be the character that I think he was always intended to be, but had very few opportunities to be that character.
Yeah, Nemesis is this interesting guy in that, I mean, and I think this is true of obviously a lot of characters, both at Marvel and DC, that there's a world of potential that almost anybody can see right away, but he hasn't necessarily lived up to that potential, which is not to say that he's not used well so much as he's always sort of an accessory to someone else's story.
Absolutely, yeah.
And, you know, some of the great stuff that, like, you know, in Suicide Squad way back when, you know, he would be a great twist in the story, but never the story.
Yep.
And you know, a lot of the goal to this is to really, really give Nemesis... a lot of the story and a lot of what Nemesis is dealing with is that Nemesis hasn't really been established with his own personality, and a lot of that is because Nemesis spends his life as other people and doesn't really have his own personality past a point. And so a lot of the story is about that and what Nemesis sort of has to grow as a unique, you know, as a person to get out of this place.
You know, he's part Nick Fury, he's part Christopher Chance, the Human Target.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, that's, I think there are a lot of...
He's got one of the coolest names, too, Nemesis. Come on, Nemesis is like...
and even that Scales of Justice emblem of his as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Nemesis, just by virtue of name, should be top dog in the DCU. So.
No, that's cool, man. Hey, and I already love what you've done with the spy world in the DCU. With that Faces of Evil Cobra issue.
Oh, thank you. Thank you very much.
Really, that was great, man. I mean, it's, again, Cobra is another good example of a great concept, and Marty Pascoe touched it, and I know it started with Jack Kirby and a lot of ideas of Jack Kirby's, and I think there's a lot of fertile ground, and especially, too, in today's environment, to have the terrorist threat of a group like the Cobra Cult.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, for me, that was exactly with Cobra, which actually came after Escape. For me, as a gig, I mean, Cobra was just all about going through and looking at. I mean, a lot of the stuff that I'm doing. I mean, I'm dealing with Kirby's Global Peace Agency, obviously here in Escape from the original OMAX series,
mm-hmm.
And a lot of that is trying to sort of figure out. I think a lot of people like to revamp things past a certain point, and what I'm trying to do is not to figure out, like, hey, this is a crappy concept, let me make it better, but what's the goal here, and what's the emotional core of these characters, and, you know, how do you apply that to a modern context and make them sort of relevant to people? And it's not about reinventing, it's sort of about re-envisioning, I guess, if that makes any sense, just really sort of looking at them with a fresh set of eyes, And I mean, in both of these cases, in Escape, I mean, not with Nemesis personally, but with the environment, with the Electric City, and the Global Peace Agency, it's about going in. I mean, shit, Kirby was 50 times smarter than I am, and there was some amazing concepts. I mean, there's a lot of that stuff that's being brought through for that. And with Cobra, it was a very similar thing, going through and trying to connect with, more than anything, with the very first issue that they did, and to really connect with, you know, what I thought he was going for, and how that, you know, how the core of that idea can be applied to the world that we live in now. And beyond that, because I think a lot of people tend to think when you do anything that deals with terrorism that it's a literal commentary on the state of the world, and it's not really, in that case, it wasn't really so much that as it was, you know,
terror with a small T.
Well, no, it's terror for sure with a big T, but it's terror. It's not a commentary. Like for me, when I look at the DCU or I look at the Marvel Universe, these are not the real world. I mean, there is sort of a strength lately to giving them realisms that people, I think, can connect with them and making them dark and so on and so forth. But I think, you know, you're not tied down when you're writing a DC comic by, you know, what an actual terrorist would have to do, or by, you know, or by any of those realities. And you're living in the DCU, you're living in a really, really amazing heightened reality. And, you know, I try to look at things less from how they affect, you know, our news cycle, and more how possibly, I guess, similar intentions would be expressed in that context. So I sort of get tuned out when writers get too heavily into their own sort of weird political agendas, and their books are very clearly sort of a weird manifestation of that. And so this definitely, you know, I always try to shy away from, you know, and it'll happen with Escape, in, you know, in that you have a guy being held prisoner. And so people will immediately get into the obvious parallels in terms of, you know, be it a Guantanamo Bay or whatever. I try to shy away from that stuff. I mean, that stuff is in your head whether you like it or not, but it's never about, for me anyway, it's never about political commentary, because, you know, there are much smarter and much more qualified people than comics writers to do that kind of stuff.
Electric City, have we seen it yet as it is now in the DC Universe, or will Escape be the first time we've seen it?
Yeah, everything is new.
Okay. And as you say, the faceless Sentinels, these are the OMACs, you know. Is this happening on Earth 1, or we don't know, or we're not sure exactly where we are even to that extent?
Yeah, you don't know, even to that degree, you don't know where or when Electric City is.
Okay. Very cool. How long is Escape going to be?
Escape is six issues long. It's me and Marco Rudy, who's one of the guys who came in to help out on Final Crisis towards the end of the run. Great, great, great young writer who's doing some really, like, not to keep getting into, you know, the uniqueness of voices or whatever, but I mean, I'm blown away by how he's chosen to approach, you know, some of the extremely, extremely creepy and weird stuff that he was handed. He has added to the story tremendously, and has really sort of busted his back to not make it look like a generic mainstream superhero comic. It's definitely told, you know, even the camera angles are very unique. We've chosen to tell it only from certain visual point of views.
Cool.
And the way that he sort of run with that ball is just really, really, really flooring. And he's, you know, again, it all comes down to, in any book, it comes down to how invested the artist is. And
sure.
Marco is super, super invested. I get an email every day with a new page or with, you know, questions, or he's really about making this his best work. And it's cool, because you don't really know when you're doing this kind of book, and it's not your baby, sort of. You know, they're editors and so on, and they have the ultimate say in stuff, and you don't know how invested anybody's going to be. So it's really impressive when you get, you know, you get people reacting like it's, you know, it's the same process that I have when working on an Image comic. It's that same kind of energy and that same kind of spirit of collaboration. And, you know, when I throw some really crazy shit at Dan DiDio, he throws even crazier stuff back. So it's a really, really weird, unique, and fun working experience that is definitely not what I expected. And, you know, I think people, when they see, I haven't seen the other Aftermath books. I know I've spoken to Dan about his intent, but I think that's pretty much the intent across the line with this series, is that it not at all feel like a DC series. Like people, I think, have a lot of preconceptions these days, and, you know, maybe some of them warranted, when they go and they pick up a DC book, and they're going out of their way not to do that, to really sort of make something new here. So, I mean, to that end, I've been given a lot of great notes, a lot of freedom, you know, and I'm really happy with that.
Let me ask some more general DCU questions. Will we see any other reboots of some basic concepts other than Electric City and Nemesis himself?
In Escape?
Yes.
Let's see, how can I say this without... There's a lot of familiar DCU stuff used in an unfamiliar way. There are a lot of characters that... another character, for example, that I'm really really into writing, who is in the book, but I can't say in which capacity, is Amanda Waller. And Amanda Waller is one of those really great characters in that she could be, you know, equivalent to a Doctor Doom or something in terms of the scope of, you know what I'm saying? She's got her fingers in every single pie. She really knows all of the dirty secrets of the DCU, and so she's a lot of fun to deal with, and she's a lot of fun to explore sort of, you know, A, what scares her, and B, you know, to what degree, when you have someone like that, you know, someone like that caged, to what, you know, the level of what she's capable of is a lot of fun to play with. So she's in the book. There's a lot of stuff that's familiar. I can't really explain, but I think Ian Sattler sort of spilled a little bit of a thing on this. But if you look at when the second issue cover comes out, there's a time pool, and so there are a lot of things like the time pool that are very familiar DCU things that are being that I'm using in ways that they weren't intended. it's fun because it's that big question mark of what exactly is going on. So there's definitely a lot of super familiar stuff. Almost everything in Electric City or in Escape is stuff that has been in the DCU, but almost none of it is used the way it's been used before.
Because I guess based on what I heard at panels in New York, it sounded like, you know, yeah, that Escape was kind of also stemming from the way Checkmate wrapped up, and I'm not sure if that's the case, in, you know, or not.
Yes and no. Checkmate is involved. It's not. A lot of people have asked me if the GPA is just, you know, another DC organization, much like Checkmate.
Right.
You know, in some weird hierarchy, as we would have, like the FBI or the CIA, and that's definitely not the case. And I think Checkmate doesn't know what's going on. Put it that way.
All right. Okay. Even cooler. All right. That's great.
Nobody knows what the GPA is all about until Escape.
Very cool, man. How about have you talked to Gail Simone, who I guess has been handling Nemesis in that kind of supporting role in Wonder Woman most recently?
No, I haven't talked to her personally. I know a bit of what's going on with her in terms of Nemesis. I have not spoken to her personally. But there is definitely some stuff coming up, I know, for Nemesis and Wonder Woman that should be intriguing to folks. But yeah, I haven't spoken to anybody, but on a creator level, I haven't really spoken to anybody at DC about any of this stuff. I've been working in sort of a bubble of, you know, keeping my head down and every couple of weeks I'll go in and sit down with Dan and Rex and bang stuff up and bang stuff out, and then you know, come back to my cave and make some more creepy stuff on my own.
And not that I need it, but you know, there are continuity nerds that'll demand this answer, so let's just throw it out there anyway. would the events of whatever happens to Nemesis in Wonder Woman, would they be before Escape or after Escape? Where is it in the timeline?
I don't know.
Interesting. Okay, even better. That's the best answer. Good for you, man. Good. No, that's good, man. Make them work for the story. I haven't had a
problem. Yeah, it's you know, like I said, I every part of those things is an integral part to the mystery of Escape.
So. Well, it sounds like a hell of a mind fuck. Good, very good, man. That's good.
That's the goal. That's the goal. And, you know, people, the goal. My job is basically the mind fucking I can do. My job is to make it still compelling enough that even if you don't have all the answers, you still want to stick around. And I think that's why I mentioned Lost, where you have a context where, you know, shit, 3 years into it, people still don't know all of what's going on.
Sure.
But if you're connecting with the characters and you're interested in seeing what they're dealing with and how they deal with these things, I think we're all along for a fun ride.
Well, that's great, man. I'm one of those old farts that remembers The Prisoner, and that's well before Lost, the best mindfuck that I remember. And,
yeah, I think no offense to Lost, I think The Prisoner is up on a level with very few shows. It's one of the, for me, it's one of the greatest shows ever. So I mean, certainly in terms of things, you know, dealing with intrigue, for me it's one of the absolute best.
I really hope this AMC reimagining is as good as, let's say, the Battlestar Galactica reimagining has been, if not better. You know,
I hope so too. I've heard weird conflicting things about it, and I know that they're not doing a straight. They've
right.
changed quite a bit. From what I've heard,
I know
they've
too.
Changed quite a bit, and I hope I hope it's all for the better. I'm very curious to see it again. It's I will watch it regardless. It's something that's very close to my heart. So. If it's just for them to burn the concept down and ruin it, I'm along for the ride.
What'd you think of Nowhere Man back in the 90s from UPN? Did you ever watch that?
No, I never did.
You know, I thought that was a pretty good Prisoner-esque attempt. And Bruce Greenwood, who's going to be Christopher Pike in the upcoming Star Trek movie, I thought was a very good, for the 90s, kind of number six character, and I thought did a very good job. And it was its own interesting little puzzle that... You know, could have been a cool show, maybe if it was on a different network, or maybe if it was coming on now, as opposed
right.
to 10 years ago. So
yeah, that's the. It's funny the dynamic of like how HBO or whatever works into programming these days. It's funny that like it just creates these confounding conversations where, you know, in the times where I've talked to people about developing stuff for television, I'll be like, you know, yeah, this is okay, but it's not. This is primetime okay. This isn't HBO okay. Like we need to reach a little further. We need something that's beyond that. I think there's very few things that you know the Prisoner obviously being a good example, and you know Mad Men right now on AMC.
Absolutely.
There's very few things that are sort of elevated beyond just which is not to say that those things don't have value either. I mean you know escapist entertainment is escapist entertainment, and it for sure has its value. But there's a different level, and some of the things that I've been dealing with it makes a person into a spoiled snob that needs to try to bring things to that level, which is even sadder when you try to reach for that level and then you fail because then you're just a high-reaching douchebag.
Well, we talked before, and unfortunately my computer ate the conversation, but we mentioned the show Kings, and I know you haven't seen it yet, but I think that's one of those shows that it is a big gamble for network TV to be like an HBO, and I don't think it will make it. But I do think it'll be interesting to watch while it's on, and in the same way that some of these other shows. God, 2 years ago, there was a great caper show on CBS with Ray Liotta called Smith. And,
yeah.
And I thought it was such a great idea, and I really enjoyed the pilot, and it was doomed. And I don't think it made it six episodes even. You know?
Yeah, it's tough. I know they've had a lot of trouble. I forget what – there was another mob show or something on NBC a couple years ago that was intended to be the new – you know, where it was something like this, where they were very deliberately trying to make a cable program for
I know the one you're talking about too, because yeah, then they were trying to test it on Bravo and some of their other Universal NBC properties.
Yeah, and it just didn't work out. I mean, it would be great if they could. You know, I don't know if those streams cross. I don't know if the same people who watch you know Heroes watch The Sopranos. I really don't know. You know.
Well, I think, and I'm kind of I think luckily network TV is at least. Thinking about changing to the basic cable mode of let's just commit to, you know, 13 episodes and tell
right.
a whole story And if that's it, well, then at least we've given the viewers that they have a full story. And if it, you know, if it is good, then we'll have some, you know, a good starting point to build another season on. There's that show Murder House that's coming up on CBS with Jeffrey Bell. And that seems to be a finite series that, you know, CBS is trying to do. So, you know, because of the success of things, even like Damage is now in its second season, you know, some of the FX shows and some of the HBO shows. Yeah, maybe network TV is finally figuring out that maybe 22 episodes is too much to ask for an audience. But if you keep it short, you know, maybe you can run it and rerun.
I mean, as a creative entity, to go in, you know, to go in and just focus and do 13 amazing, or 10 to 13, because some of these guys only have 10.
Yep.
So 10 to 13 amazing episodes. You know, put all of it, what you put into 22 episodes into 13, versus, you know, what ends up happening on a lot of these things. And even, you know, like some of the shows like Battlestar Galactica, for example, would have all these episodes that people would complain that they're just filler.
Yep.
You know, I think a lot of these decisions get made more for, we have this show that's somewhat successful and we don't have another one to fill those slots 2 months from now. So let's make 20 episodes of it because we still need something at 8 o'clock, you know, in March and not just in January. And I think, you know, that's what ends up happening. But, you know, at the end of the day, I think people would, you know, the shows would be better suited maybe by, you know, like Kings, you know, we were talking earlier about, you know, they hired a quote-unquote HBO crew to do the first 6 episodes. Now, who knows what happens when they leave? Hopefully it's it continues to be great. I haven't seen it, so assuming it's great, hopefully it continues to be that way. But you know what I'm saying? If you could focus and just say, fuck it, let's just do those 6. Let's just make great six great episodes of television and put everything we got into those and knock people on their asses. And you know what I'm saying? Connect the creative concerns from the you know, from filling slots in your schedule.
Well, and it seems like, you know, you go back 30 years, they kind of understood that with things like Rich Man, Poor Man, which was an incredible one season story, and Roots, certainly, which was a limited series.
Sure.
You know, and again, you look at the examples of what cable has done, and of course what England does. I mean, God, we talk about 10 or 13 episodes. Hell, they can do it with 6 episodes a lot of times.
Right. Jekyll, yeah, I mean, The Office, I think, has done a really great job of making the American version very unique. But the original format was 6 hours total.
Yep.
You know, it's two 6-episode half-hour format seasons.
Well, and even like Life on Mars, which I loved on British TV, you know, it was only, I think, 16 episodes total, and they were fearful about going into a second season.
I've only ever seen the very first episode of the British show, not because I didn't like it, but for whatever reason I never got around to watching the rest of it, and then it became, you know, it went all the way to the end, and then I think they've done a sequel since then now, right?
Well, yeah, there's a new series that, you know, kind of addresses some of the questions that weren't answered, and you
gotcha.
Know, it's pretty good. Yeah, it's BBC America is actually running it now, called Ashes to Ashes.
Gotcha.
And it takes place a decade later, and a lot of the same characters, but it's a different lead, and it's a different lead character in the same situation.
Right.
So it's a cool show. No, I'm a big fan of it. And, you know, I think, and again, even in the case of what you're doing with Vikings, yeah, you know, tell your strongest story, let that sell itself, and then, you know, and let the audience find it.
The beauty of it, for good or for ill, like, you know, with Viking, for example, I don't have the luxury of filling time. You know, I have a book that I have to assume is on its deathbed. I have to treat every episode like that, and you have to, you know, go out of your way to make every episode knock people on their ass, or there's not going to be another episode. So, I mean, I think there is a sense of urgency and a sort of, you know, a hunger there to connect with people in that way, because you don't have, you know, season 3 where you know, I've only got 15 episodes of ideas, but I've got 20 hours to fill. You know, I don't have that luxury. I don't have, you know, and I'm glad I don't for in terms of that, because it makes me, you know, it makes me and Nick basically have to bring, you know, to approach it very, very seriously and really go through and cut all the bullshit out, you know. And some of the stuff, you know, it's not to say that every single thing that happens in Viking is some momentous battle, but, you know, everything is essential to to character development. It's essential to the forward progress of the story that we're trying to tell. So, I mean, I think I know for my sake that fear of not being able to finish your story means that I only get to tell the story, that I only try to tell the story that I know, you know, I'm saying, the essential story.
Mm-hmm.
Because I want to make sure if I get, you know, whatever finish line I get to is going to be something that I'm proud of in the end.
Right.
I mean, luckily in my case, the announcement that is coming, you'll see, we've been super lucky in terms of how we've done on the first issue. But I mean, when we went into it, we had to assume, you know, it's a crazy idea doing a period book. When we decided to do it, the economy wasn't in the horrid state that it's in. But once we were on board with soliciting on all that stuff, it was, you know. And so we had to realize that we were doing a very risky thing, and certainly not something that there was any, you know, giant screaming demand for outside of our own personal homes. So, you know, it makes you get very, very, very serious about what you're doing very, very quickly. It should.
Well, from what I've been able to tell from the PDF, not seeing what the packaging is looking like, it is a good first issue, and I look forward to the next four, and good luck with it. Let me ask you about, also, before we get off of DC, Cobra, will you be going back to this? This was a one-shot, but will we see you returning to the Cobra world?
There's nothing to announce just yet, but I know that there will be the Cobra that I created. It definitely has a very important part in the DCU in the coming months.
Okay.
So that's kind of all I can say.
Fair enough. What else have you got? Didn't they make announcements for you at Marvel at the New York Con?
No, they did not. We have stuff. We have stuff cooking, but unfortunately, nothing that I can
blab about now.
Speak on. But the stuff that we, I mean, just to speak of working with Marvel in general. I mean, I've actually been extremely lucky. I think a lot of creator-owned guys either just do their creator-owned stuff just to hopefully get noticed by Marvel and then or DC, and then just do Marvel and DC books, and then the other guys get nervous that they're not going to be able to sort of be creative on those books. And I've been super, super lucky. I mean, when I did I did Machine Man with Nico Hanresham.
Oh yeah.
At Marvel, and that was another context where my editor John Barber, that was a really crazy series. I mean, that was really one of the most absurd and strange things I've ever done. And it was the same kind of thing. I would send him, you know, 10 crazy ideas. And then he'd be like, all right, you know, I would get encouraged, you know. The weirder I got, the more I got encouraged to be weird. It was, it's really cool. I think, you know, it's potentially a really interesting place where you can have, and you know, I don't want to say that everything is about being weird. It just so happens that these particular stories are weird. I'm also, the stuff that I'm working on right now for Marvel specifically is not weird at all and is very dark, serious stuff. But you know, I think it's an interesting time when you have people that realize that, I guess, guys who have come up in a different way, I guess, and told stories in a different way, that those guys can fit into, I guess, a big corporate beast in a different way and in a valid way. And I've been really, really lucky in terms of people wanting me to come in and do my thing versus do their thing, which is not to say that their thing is bad, you know, but that I do things a little differently. And I've been super lucky with that. I've been only encouraged by both Marvel and DC to be unique with my voice, and that for me, you know, I made a crack recently that, you know, that someone asked me about breaking into comics and, you know, or what, you know, about being a storyteller, or about being whatever. And I said, if you're not, I don't understand why people, and this is a criticism actually I have about quote unquote, comics, journalism or reviewers or any of that stuff. Which is why I like talking to you. Cause you definitely do a great and unique thing. But there are so many guys that very clearly come into the business from whatever aspect, be it a reviewing blog, podcast, comic writer, comic artist, just to sort of emulate the fun stuff they like. which to me is such a useless and boring way to approach things, and I don't understand the point to it. I just, if you're reading, you know, if I'm going to do a podcast because I like John Suntry's Word Balloon, you know, there's already a guy doing that. And what I've said to guys who go in and like, oh, I really love Jeff Johns DC Comics, so I'm going to do another Jeff Johns DC Comic. Well, it's like, shit, there's a guy doing that.
Yeah, they already got a Jeff Johns, exactly.
Right, and it's like there's already a Jeff Johns. He's not going anywhere. And it's like, if you don't have your own thing, he didn't come in trying to be somewhere else. You know, if you don't have your own thing to say, what's the point? I mean, if it's just there is a line between being a fan of a medium and being a whatever, you know, if we're talking about you know, any degree of journalism or creation or any of that stuff, there is a line that doesn't necessarily have to be crossed. Like, it's kind of okay just to be a guy who reads and enjoys, and you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
Like, I did that for a very good part of my life, and I enjoyed it, and I didn't feel like, you know, I didn't feel like I wasn't contributing. I would go, and I had another job, and I was good at my job, and I enjoyed that too. So it was only when I've decided I had things to say and I had things that were exciting me from a storytelling perspective that I decided to sort of dip my toe into the water, because if not, shit, I've made more money, you know, working dot-coms in '90s than I did in comics. You know, like I would have, you know, the dot-com bubble burst at that point, so maybe that's a bad example, but you know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
If you're a little kid dreaming about whether or not you want to be a lawyer or a doctor or an astronaut or a comic creator, you know, as things go on paper, comics is a pretty shitty job. From a creative standpoint, it's amazing. But if you're just looking to make some money or whatever, it's a shitty way to go about making that plan, and you're better off going to law school.
Yeah, I'll include comic book podcasts in that equation as well.
Yeah, no, I do think that's true, because I think so many guys just come on. I honestly, you know, it's why I was excited about doing this interview, and not to sound like to the audience that I'm kissing your ass just because we're talking here. But I get so many interviews where the interviewer has clearly cut and pasted the questions from the last interview they did, and I'm like, why did you ask me to do an interview if you don't have anything you want to ask me? You know what I'm saying?
I absolutely do, and it's
it's like, what's the point? And if you don't have anything, like any burning questions that you have to ask about comics or storytelling or whatever it is, why are you asking questions? Like, what's the point to that? Because most of these guys aren't getting paid. You know? What is the thrill to doing some shitty interview that five people are going to read that's not good? and you know what I do? When someone asks me the same question 10 times, I cut and paste it from another interview where somebody asks me the same question. You know?
Sure.
If you're not going to bother to bring the questions, I'm not going to bother to bring the answers. You know? It's like, I never understand. It's like people have this weird, you know, like this need to sort of, you know, the equivalent of pushing papers around. It's
no,
like it's
I
not...
I agree, and I also think that, yeah, you know, the comics journalism I always put in quotes because, yeah, a lot of times people are just chasing down press releases, and it is, I think, this is what I try to do with my show, is find out about the person, the creator, and their unique voice. And obviously, I think that to their credit, as you said, DC and Marvel, based on the new guys that they have approached to come in and try books, they are looking for new voices and new looks.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think that is great that the big two recognize that, you know, there is something beyond the house style, and that a new look and a new voice is only going to make their comics and their properties more interesting because they will speak with more unique voices or be presented visually in a unique way. So there's only an upside, and again, as the audience gets more adult, I think most of them tire of the repetition of the, you know, girl on the tracks and saving her, and they want new ideas for stories. So this is, you know, you're only going to get them from fresh outlooks from fresh creators.
Well, if you look at comics, you know, way back from the 1930s, whatever was considered a house style in every decade is not the same as what happens in the next decade. So at some point, there's a shift. And you're either conscious of that and you embrace it, or you're someone that's trying to hold on to what was successful for you 2 weeks ago. And I think, you know, I think it's very important to be conscious of the fact that you know, what is successful, what appeals to somebody in any given, you know, in any given era of comics is not always what they expect. And you have to be open to, you know, to bringing the new voice to the world. Otherwise, it's not going to, you know, you're going to get lost. Eventually, you're going to be making 1970s comics in the year 2000, and people are going to get people are going to look for the next guy. People are going to look for, you know, a lot of the guys doing you know, on the bigger books or doing the more interesting stuff are guys who came from indie comics. I mean, Matt Fraction, look at, you know, guy who came from doing some really strange, weird shit outside of Marvel, but, you know, he's one of the hottest guys over there now. I mean, you have to appreciate that it's not the same old shit that's appealing to people now. And so if you don't embrace and you don't take a couple chances, you know, you're just going to be, it might as well be fan fiction, you know?
I absolutely agree. I got to ask you, because you were just on television recently. And it's,
oh, God.
You know, well, let me, first of all, you're right, oh, God. Thanks for killing, like, 2 hours of my fucking life having to watch you guys, because I don't like watching reality TV, but I had to see you, Joe Kelly, and Paul, and Oming as well in the office, in The Celebrity Apprentice. That was really interesting and pretty funny, because, again, I hate reality TV. But thank you. Know, I really figured you guys were only going to be on for like 10 minutes or whatever. And the fact that they spent 2 hours in designing comic book ideas for Zappos.com. That...
Well, in the end, we were on for 10 minutes, but it took us 15 hours to shoot it.
So, and you spent most of the time with the women's group.
Yeah, no, we specifically came in really early in the morning.
Okay.
And they put us together with the different groups. And very soon... very soon after we'd met with each group, like Mike and I, there were three boardrooms, basically, or three, whatever you call those.
Sets or whatever.
Yeah, and conference rooms. There we
okay.
go. There were three conference rooms, and you had the ladies' room, which is where we filmed. You had the men's room, which is where they filmed
Mike and Joe
and them. And then there was a third room that was just sort of producers and fax machines and all sorts of stuff. And me and Mike and Joe and Paul... Well, less Paul after a certain point, because Paul had to be sitting there drawing the stuff after a while. But beyond that, we would go back and reconvene. So we had contact with each other, but not with the teams, because past a certain point, the teams were sort of locked. There was sort of a conflict in terms of conflicting ideas and in terms of stealing things that they weren't allowed to talk to each other, much
okay.
less the... So past once the teams were established, there was no contact between the celebrity groups and anybody but the people they were working with. So, you know, we ran into, when we first came in to the room, Scott Hamilton and Dennis Rodman and Tom Green and whomever and I picked over the craft services table together. But but after that, they all ended up in their boardroom, and beyond poor Tom Green remorsefully walking through the hallways, I didn't really get to see anybody else.
Oh, okay. Man. Well, I was surprised that the women's team, and I, you know, I rarely side with Joan Rivers, you know, post-1985, but on her
right.
side, I had to agree. I couldn't believe that, you know, the what appeared to be, at least as far as the TV portrayal showed it, the
sure.
poker champion telling her, yeah, why don't you go work on the costume? We'll handle the script. And you got the one woman who's got the most writing experience of any of those yahoos, and she's not there involved with the story. That blew my mind.
Yeah, well, it's funny because both teams sort of reacted to that specific thing the same way. Because, I mean, Tom has done movies, and Tom is
yeah.
is a writer, and both of them sort of, you know, ignored the people who were most qualified to do the work in favor of putting whomever on. It was a really weird thing. You know, Joan was very gracious, I guess, about it in person. You know, afterwards you see it on TV and you realize that when they were going and interviewing people outside of the view of everybody else, you realize that people were venting frustrations and stuff. But but she was very, very, very gracious and fun and professional is not the word, I guess, because it's not something that is to deal with their particular professions. But
sure.
she was very, very helpful. And, you know, I was actually really impressed with my team in general, I think maybe some of the portrayals of the stuff is about making everyone look like an idiot. But,
of course.
but I was actually really impressed with, I mean, shit, I've been working in comics. This is my 9th year in comics. And there are members of my own family that couldn't tell you what I do or how to do it. So how little I had to explain to them. I mean, and there was a lot that I explained to them, but how well they connected with the things. And once I told them what we had to do, you know, how quickly they were able to sort of understand that and work with me and not ask me a bunch of ridiculous questions the way my grandmother would. No offense to my grandmother.
Sure. No, I hear you.
But you know what I'm saying? I was very impressed with that because it's not their business, and comics is not an easy thing to understand. I know people who work in comics who don't understand how to make them, you know, beyond whatever their direct part is.
Sure.
So I was really impressed with, they did a lot of research. They were really focused. In between meeting with the Zappos guy and meeting with us, they'd been all over the internet just studying the company, studying all sorts of stuff. They were really, really focused on this stuff, and they really listened when I explained things to them, and to the degree that, you know, whether or not anybody likes what they came up with, I thought that I was impressed with how much they were able to accomplish in such a short period of time. Whether or not it was an amazing end result is a matter for anyone else's opinion, but I was really impressed with how quickly they were able to focus, and they really... You know, I'm not necessarily supposed to talk about this stuff. I did write I did sign an NDA that says I'm not supposed to. But no, they really, you know, there were points in the show where you can see Mike is sitting there, sort of scratching his head, frustrated, not doing anything. And we were already well into drawing ours and producing it when they were still arguing over what the name was.
Well, the thing I will say for both, and I'm glad to see that the CEO from Zappos also said this at the end as well, I do think both presentations turned out well.
I thought they were very professional. They were, oddly enough, they were almost exactly the same presentation in the end. But
But that's okay. I mean, and it didn't surprise me. You would go with a female. I mean, you're going for a female audience, so why not give that empowerment to a female superhero? And
sure, at the time it was funny, though, because Mike would come in and be drawing, and Paul would be drawing at the table. And we'd realize, we finally looked at the layout of the panels, and we were like, wow, they really, like, in a vacuum, not knowing what each other were doing, they came up with a very similar concept.
Well, unfortunately, the only knock on the men, and certainly Tom Green was the only one screaming the right thing, you know, to call their hero E, as opposed to, Kelly Sue, we're watching it, and as I'm sure a lot of us do, we're Twittering as we're watching, so we're all... We're all watching comments, and I saw Kelly Sue DeConnick saying that, you know, why don't they just call it ZEE?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, or ZZZ or something.
Yeah, well, even like just Zappos everywhere, every time, or something like that. It was so funny how, oh, well.
Yeah, it was rough because for us, you know, like, we weren't allowed to comment directly on things. I was basically, you know, I can't get too specific, but I was basically... My goal was to give them the tools by which to fail or succeed.
Okay.
But once they started creating, I couldn't really opine.
Okay.
So they would ask me, like, is this good? Do you think our idea is good? And a producer would whisper in my ear, you have no opinion on that.
Yeah, but it's Brandy Roderick that's asking me, man.
Right, exactly.
How do I refuse this playmate that's gorgeous?
Right. Yeah, it was tough for us because it was just like, not that we thought it was terrible, but there were certain things obviously that you see that you would have done differently or that you know better about, and they don't, and you kind of can't tell them, unfortunately.
Sure.
And so you sort of have to sit and bite your tongue and wince a little bit and see how they go. But I think you know, Mike, although, you know, fortunately in that, I guess it was probably more entertaining for him, but I think Mike had definitely the much more difficult group to deal with in terms of that stuff.
Yeah, well, that's what it looked like on television. Obviously, were the women nice to work with, though? Honestly,
the women, there was very little conflict for the most part between any of them. They, like I said, they were very focused. They had differences of opinion, and they didn't necessarily always come to a consensus on opinion, but they were pretty good about talking it through and not getting into sort of, you know, strange arguments and whatever. They were good about listening, like I say. They were definitely focused. You know what I'm saying? They didn't always do everything as easily as possible or the way I would do it, but they were very focused and they were very driven. In the end, they really got to, you know, they got to what they wanted to do, and they got there pretty quickly. I mean, considering, again, I, you know, to create anything within a day. And I granted they didn't draw the thing, but beyond that, to do some of that stuff in a day, it's not easy. And, you know, again, by the end of the day, our deadline at the end of the night, that comic had to be finished, and it was. So it was, they had to work well. If they were bickering, it was with each other and not with me.
Okay.
And rarely that even. So I was very impressed with how they treated me. I thought, you know, a lot of the like Chloe, who was the team manager, was super nice and, you know, very warm.
Is she the poker champ?
She's
the poker champ, right?
No, Chloe Kardashian.
Oh, no. This is Kim Kardashian's sister, Chloe. Yes, of course.
Exactly. Yeah, Annie Duke was the poker player.
Okay.
Annie was very driven, maybe to a way that I guess annoyed some of the other gals. I will admit frankly that I did not know she wasn't the team leader.
Oh, that's hilarious.
If that makes any sense to you,
because yeah, I understand.
She
what you're
made it very much seem like she was, but she was very nice to me, and again, you know, everybody was theoretically headed towards the same goal, and to the degree that they bristled with each other, you know, it seemed to be with the goal of winning at heart, and you know, all things being equal with the competition, it's hard to judge them too harshly for that. But
all right, well, I'll admit again, I think you know. 2 hours of my life I'd rather have back, but it wasn't terrible. And, half the fun was watching, like, you. First of all, much like every convention, your hair's sticking up, which cracked me up.
I don't know if you've done a Bendis tape since then, but Brian said his daughter. Well, first of all, which I thought was hilarious, she sat there and yelled at the screen, talking to me.
What did she say?
Like telling me that they had played Rock Band that day.
Aww.
And interacting with me on the screen, but then turned to her dad and said, "Why didn't Ivan comb his hair if he was going to be with all the pretty ladies?"
I did see that.
So there were a couple, and then she yelled, "Why isn't Mike doing anything? Why won't he do anything?"
Way to go, yeah, Olivia. That's very cool. And again, you know, there's something for the scrapbook, man.
Yeah, absolutely. No, it was. I have a bottle of Trump water on my desk now from that experience. No, it's something. You know, it wasn't the easiest thing to do, and you know, it was. It cost me a couple of days' work, but
did you meet Trump?
Well, no, I mean it's in terms of, you know, in terms of my own deadline. I understand that,
but I'm asking if you did meet Trump, though.
Oh, no, I did not meet Trump. No, okay. Trump's son, I didn't realize who he was at the time because I hadn't followed the first season. I didn't realize that it was his son. But his son was in the boardroom, in our conference room.
Yeah, okay.
Briefly, but he didn't, we didn't do it at the Trump Tower. We did it at this location elsewhere in the city. And so I think when they did their little boardroom where people get fired and all that stuff, that was the next day.
I understand.
At the Trump Tower. So he wasn't physically there.
He didn't come by and say, "Thank you very much for your participation."
No, he did not.
Okay, fine. That's too bad.
He did not. And, so I can't tell you whether or not his hair is real.
Yeah. Jesus, man. Well, I never even got that close to him at the few fights that I would see him at. I was always too far away to take notice of that. Not that I really would have welcomed the interview, quite frankly, but that's how I am. Jesus.
He's an interesting, those interviews are always hilarious, the boardroom stuff, because it's just like, he's got a very Larry Kingian kind of thing where he just, he mutters random stuff he interjects the weirdest things that you don't expect that have nothing to do with anything.
It was a good episode, at least. It was fun seeing all you guys, because it really was like being at a con, and it's like, oh my God, there's Joe! Oh my God, there's Mike!
Yeah, well, it was fun for us because we filmed it in October, so it was fun to
crazy.
We were finally able to speak about that, and people were able to see it. We weren't even know, we didn't even know at some point whether or not we could announce it with our NDA, but it was fun to finally see it on screen, and it's funny because you don't realize how masterful editors, meaning film editors, are until you see them. Remove 15 hours of dialogue from when you realize you've been on screen for 15 hours and you've said quite a bit and you've been you've been reduced to a couple minutes of for two whole sentences.
Yeah.
You realize how masterful, and they had time. They got time before they get to us. They have their little quarters, and then afterwards they have the boardroom stuff. So you got to imagine that they have a good 20 to 24 hours of footage.
Jesus.
that they have to weed through to get to those 2 hours.
That's insane.
So Oof. People would ask me if I was going to be on the show, and I was like, "Of course." I was like, "They shot 15 hours. They couldn't cut me out of that." And I was like, "Well, nope. I guess not. I guess they could edit out, 15 hours worth of stuff."
God.
But it was funny because everybody was like, "Oh, I did an interview. People were like, oh, yeah, how quickly the thing moved." I was like, "It was 15 hours. It didn't move quickly at all." But the way that they edited it, it seemed like, like a tense 40 minutes.
Sure. Absolutely.
Which it absolutely was not.
Wow.
We ate three separate meals,
Oh, my God. No, I thought you guys did a good job. I felt bad for the nerds. Did you get subjected to the nerds? I remember them being with the men. For some reason, I don't remember them being with the
men. No, yeah, they were with us. And okay. I actually felt bad only because they went out of their way to focus on maybe the guys who were a little quote-unquote nerdier.
Yeah.
And there were some guys who were less so, and everybody was very nice and very helpful, and I felt bad that they, I'm sure they all called their moms and grandmothers and everybody to tell them they were going to be on The Apprentice, and then to have someone say that they'd probably never gotten laid or whatever, whatever it was. Oh, a bunch of virgins or whatever it was.
Yeah, no, I know. It's like, hey, man,
I mean, it was. I would admit, I maybe chuckled a little bit at the time, but in hindsight, I felt really bad that they had to be on TV to have someone crack a joke at their expense. I chuckled in a less personal way, in that anybody makes that joke about anybody, it's kind of funny. But then you think about it, and you're like, yeah, you know what? Those guys were just trying to help.
Well,
they didn't really need to.
And as you say too, they want to intensify any type of reaction they can get, the editors and the producers. So, hey, man, there's a reason why I do audio instead of a lot of video.
right.
First of all, and secondly, as I like to say to my friends, you could have the cure for cancer, but God forbid you have a hair out of place and you're on TV delivering said cure, you're an idiot.
Yeah,
and God forbid your fly might be open or something. Look at the idiot that. Yeah, but he just told us about the cure for cancer. He's an idiot. His fly is open. Look at that. And it's that's the power of television, kids.
Well, look, Obama was on Leno a couple weeks ago.
Yes,
or whatever it was, last week, and he made this one comment about something about the Special Olympics, and the minute he said it, I was like, oh, tomorrow everybody's going to talk about just that. That one silly comment that I'm sure he regretted it the minute he said it, but tomorrow it's all going to be, no matter what he said, no matter, he could have said the most amazing thing ever, and people loved it. And it's pretty admirable that a president went and sat in a talk show and goofed around with a guy, and that was a pretty cool thing to happen, whether or not anybody is a fan of him personally or whatever. But, he makes one silly comment that he shouldn't have made, sure. But, what I'm saying? It was one of those things that you immediately said it, and you're like, oh.
Yep.
You really got to be on your guard. You say one word wrong, and it all becomes about that word.
Absolutely. No, and we spent the day hearing damage control and, admonishment for making that kind of remark. I'm sure Rush and Sean and all the righties had a field day with it.
Oh, yeah. Rush. Rush, who talks about
Michael J. Fox.
Yeah, Michael J. Fox and whatever else. Rush, I'm sure, was suddenly the biggest defender of
the Special Olympics.
Of special needs. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
My friends, can you believe this man is in our White House?
How dare he disrespect our amazing special needs population?
Jesus. Well, have I missed anything, Ivan? Is there anything else we should cover?
I think that might be everything.
Okay. Well, very cool. Regardless, I will see you at the FX show in Orlando then.
Yeah, absolutely, in a couple weeks. Yeah.
Excellent. And thank you for your time. And once, both Vikings and Escape are rolling and everything, I'm sure we'll have more to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'd love to touch base and see once the votes are in, so to speak, when people have actually checked the thing out, we should talk again.
Quick reminder, you'll be able to see Ivan and a whole bunch of creators at the FX show this weekend in Orlando, Florida. He will be there. John Hickman will be there. Matt Fraction, B. Clay Moore, Michael Golden, Mark Texaria, Steve Rude, a host of others, including media stars like Leonard Nimoy, all will be at the FX International show in Orlando, Florida this weekend, the 17th through the 19th. And if you want more information about the con, go to fxshow.com.
That's all the time we have today on Word Balloon, where today it was sponsored by InStock Trades at InStockTrades.com, where they offer a wide selection of trade paperbacks, hardcovers, essentials, original graphic novels, omnibus editions, all at 35% or more off the cover price. And if you would like to make a purchase of $50 or more at InStockTrades.com, you get free shipping. Some of the other products from Ivan Brandon available at InStock Trades: Marvel's Secret Invasion Home Invasion Trade Paperback at InStockTrades.com, just $9.44. Also, how about Rule, Ganglords of Chinatown? A great collaboration between Jeff Amano, Ivan Brandon, and Mike Hawthorne. The standard retail price on that trade paperback is $19.99 at InStockTrades.com, just $12.59. And how about NYC Mech Volume 2, Beta Love? The standard retail price is $14.99, but at InStockTrades.com, just $9.44. Don't forget about their sister site, Discount Comic Book Service, at DCService.com for all your monthly pre-order needs. They have monthly specials of up to 75%, and you get up to 40% off major publishers. For all the details, check out the websites, Discount Comic Book Service, DCBService.com, InStockTrades at InStockTrades.com. John Sutcher saying thanks again for listening. And reminding you that if you'd like to contact the program, you can do that in many ways. You can visit our forum at wordballoon.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, John Wordballoon. You can also reach me via email, john@wordballoon.com. Thanks again for listening, and make sure you look for more of our shows coming up throughout the month of April and into May. And we'll have full coverage of the FX show as well, which again is this weekend in Orlando. Hope to see you there. But in the meantime, Word Balloon is a copyright feature of Shaky Productions. Copyright 2009.